Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Healing and Hope for Addicts. We have an interview with the director of the Olive Branch Centre for Recovering Addicts, based in Northern England, and The Marvel and Grace of Hope. Dominican preacher and poet Father Paul Murray brings us a reflection on hope that cannot be extinguished despite all the odds against it.
La speranza apre nuovi orizzonti.
Hope opens up new horizons, said Pope Francis recently, shortly after he began a new series of catechesis reflecting on the virtue of Christian hope. Likewise, the importance and resilience of retaining hope despite the trials and tribulations we may encounter is the underlying message in our reports featured on today's programme. In particular, the need to provide hope and healing to those on the margins of society is a theme that has been at the heart of the words and actions of the Pope from the start of his papacy. That mission is shared by the founders of the Olive Branch Centre for Recovering Addicts, which is based in Wirral in Northern England. As a reformed alcoholic and drug addict, the director of the centre, Damien Prescott, knows only too well the hell of being prey to an addiction. And he spoke to Philippa Hitchin about their work at this centre and the importance of bringing a message of hope to those they are trying to help.
For the last 10 years or so, I've been working with drug addicts and more recently with people who have problems with alcohol. A couple of years ago, myself, my wife and some friends were just talking about how can we make a real difference? How can we impact on the lives of these people? And we started talking about when we see people getting well from addiction, when we see people recovering, the impact not just on their own lives and the lives of their families, but on the broader community is profound. What it's a privilege for me to see in my work and life is people getting well, becoming drug free, making a difference in their own life, and then going out and carrying a message of hope to other addicts, but also just engaging with the community, with society in a different way. When people get into recovery, they want to give back. And so we thought we want to harness this energy. So we set up an organisation called the Olive Branch Recovery Communities. And the work that we do at the moment, we currently have a recovery community detox house where people come and live. They move into a community, they become part of a community. And over a period of 6 to 12 months, they'll detox from a methadone prescription. See, when heroin hit the streets in Liverpool and the Wirral Birkenhead in the 1980s, there was a major, major crisis. People were dying, they were losing limbs. Communities were very unsafe because of the crime that addiction generated. So a crisis response was needed. And the way the state tackled that and local authorities tackled that was with methadone. And so what happens in the Wirral where I work in Birkenhead is basically they took people in off the streets, they cast the nets out wide, they brought people in, gave them methadone and then let them go as a substitute for the heroin, which basically meant that they wouldn't need to use street drugs. It solved a major problem, but in its wake it created another one, created a whole other problem. So now in the Wirral we have about 2,000 people who are dependent on methadone. It's very limiting. It's a ball and chain. And it also prevents them from becoming fully authentic human beings and reaching their full potential.
So this is why you decided that a centre would be able to work on these people particularly.
Exactly. So we have a house where they can come and they can do a slow reduction of their methadone. They're not using street drugs. It's illicit drug-free in the house. And we provide them with a safe environment to do a detox. There's no rush to complete it. But what we do insist on is that they engage in recovery practices, that they look at basically the underlying issues, what's going wrong. But more importantly, much more importantly, what's going right in my life? What are my gifts? We run a series of programs. They're actually informed by the teachings of Bernard Lonergan, the Canadian Jesuit priest, philosopher and theologian. And it's a journey of self-exploration. The programs that we offer these guys is a journey of self-exploration. And principally what we want them to explore is their own inherent value, their dignity, their beauty. So it's, I suppose in a way it's a form of new evangelization. We're preaching the gospel, but not necessarily with words.
So what kind of staff have you got working with you?
There are four directors who, three of us have personal histories of addiction. So we're in personal recovery. And I think that experience is very useful and very helpful.
In connecting to the people who are coming through your doors.
Yeah, it provides you with an authenticity that, you know, it's we're credible witnesses to the possibility of recovery. I would like to draw a link between recovery and redemption. You know, I'm convinced, the more I've been working in this field, the more I'm becoming convinced that addiction is really, it's part of the human condition. And that if you're not, you know, while some people are addicted to drugs, I think we're all addicted to something. It's part of our fallen human nature. And if that's the case, if addiction is part of the human condition, then perhaps recovery is another way of looking. It's another lens through which we can look at redemption. And certainly what I see in my work is when people grasp recovery, you witness a redemptive process happening. You witness transformation. Bernard Longan spoke of conversion on different levels, and there are four levels of conversion really that we invite these guys to engage in. First of all will probably be the psychic level, you know, so there's a real healing journey needs to happen. And then there's an implicit religious conversion. Now, it may not necessarily be explicit, but certainly people will change the orientation of their life towards a different value system.
Even people who've had no faith background.
Yeah, yeah. And what's very exciting is you do see very often a more explicit conversion taking place when people start to recover. And there is a willingness to talk about the real issues of life, you know. Carl Jung said that addiction is spiritus contra spiritum. So it's the spirit of alcohol against the spirit of the Holy Spirit. And the solution, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum. So the Holy Spirit against the spirit of alcohol. And certainly we encourage the people who do our programs and who live in the community detox house to engage with healing of all the dimensions of the person. So spiritual, intellectual, social, emotional, and a level of soul, you know, the healing of the wounds and the hurts that very often lie at the root of their addiction.
What kind of success rates, or even can you talk about success rates if people are coming completely off the drugs?
Yeah, we can. I mean, we've had about 100 people have started the programs with us in the past year, and 50% of them have completed. And most of those who've completed have detoxed from methadone, which is notoriously difficult to come off. And many others are in the process still of detoxing and are still engaging with us, and we're working towards helping them become drug-free. So I would say at this stage, tentatively, we're looking at some very good outcomes. But what's really special is that the quality of change there. And we can't take ownership of that. You know, the recovery journey involves a whole community of people in recovery who are supporting them, you know. And if I'm really honest, the best thing we can do is introduce people to that community, because really that's where it happens.
Can you give us a profile of the kind of people who are coming through your doors? Are they young people, older people, unemployed people?
They're most of them are not working. That's certainly true. Most of them would be men over the age of 40, although we do have some younger guys, because heroin is no longer as prevalent as it used to be. Younger people are not taking it so much. There's a whole other dimension of addiction going on there. Alcohol's the worry of the future, and other drugs, especially so-called legal highs. But heroin is becoming less and less prevalent among young people. But in a way, that typifies how sad it is that there's so many of the guys who are coming to us, they've been into it for a long, long time, 20, 30 years sometimes, and some of them have been in treatment for 20 years, you know. So, sure, they've been kept safe from the worst ravages of addiction, but they've been held back from really flourishing by that methadone prescription, which was meant to help them, but in a sense, and you know, what started out as a safety net turned into a dragnet and caught an awful lot of people and really wouldn't let them go, you know.
You said at the beginning that you've got your own story of redemption, recovery, that brought you into this. Can you share any of that with us?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I started drinking at a very young age, at the age of 11. And really from the very first glass, I was never in control, you know. I think probably I was very hurt and alcohol took that pain away. And so from the age of 11 all the way through my school years, really, I was drinking and it became progressively more problematic. In fact, you know, I managed to scrape through my education, but it impacted on me quite a lot. And I was becoming increasingly violent and I was regularly ending up, I was getting arrested a lot and waking up in hospitals. And, you know, I was brought up in a very comfortable, loving, middle-class, old-school Catholic home. And I was breaking my mum's heart, really, and my dad's and my brother's. And I was having a big, big impact. So one day my mum just came in and said, "You're an alcoholic, you need to go to AA." And I went and I discovered that, in fact, she was right. You know, I definitely ticked all the boxes, as it were. I did put down the booze, but then I switched for drugs because I wasn't ready to face reality. I didn't want to drink again, but I wasn't ready to face reality. So drugs were almost like my methadone, the way people will put down a heroin but pick up the methadone because they're not quite ready to go through that healing process, which is really challenging. I picked up drugs and ended up causing carnage again. And it took me a good few years to... Eventually, I became drug-free. And
was it that helped you?
Well, at the root of it was my faith. Also, fellowship with, you know, with a 12-step program. My sponsor, who I'll never be able to thank him for you know, I did many years of therapy, but what I noticed was that just going through the 12-step program with my sponsor, in a very short time, he got to the heart of my dis-ease, of my brokenness, through his own brokenness, really. He just, and also I think because he's a man who's filled with the Spirit, you know. He's a very special guy, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank him. So, yeah.
And so that's how you got into this whole ministry yourself?
That's right, yeah. And what's very exciting for me now is this process. I discovered Lonergan when I was doing a master's in theology at the Missionary Institute. And he provides a framework almost for anything at all. But it's particularly applicable with regards to the healing and the transformation of personal and social history. So what we're trying to do with the Olive Branch in a very, very small way is introduce Lonergan's insights into the human condition and into the need for healing at every level of society and at every level of the person to the field of addiction, and see where that goes from there.
That was Damien Prescott, director of the Olive Branch Centre for Recovering Addicts, based in Wirral in Northern England, interviewed by Philippa Hitchin.
We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God.
Staying on the theme of hope, we now have a reflection by the Dominican preacher and poet Father Paul Murray, who looks at the marvel and grace of human hope that cannot be extinguished despite all the odds stacked against it.
What surprises me, says God, is hope, and I can't get over it. This little hope, who seems like nothing at all. This little girl, hope, immortal. These astonishing lines are taken from a long prose poem on the theme of hope, composed by the French poet Charles Péguy in the early years of the 20th century. No author in modern times, I would say, has surpassed Péguy as the poet of the mystery of hope. According to Hans-Urs von Balthasar, Péguy was given the privilege of uttering words beyond all the fluency of theology to date. He possessed, in the opinion of Balthasar, the gift of being able to penetrate more deeply than any other Christian poet into the secrets of the tenderness of God's heart. Péguy, we discover, does not simply meditate in his work on the great dogmatic truths and mysteries of the faith. He does that, of course, and with a consistency and passion almost unique in modern times. But he does something else as well, something quite astonishing. He speaks, he dares to speak, as if he were a prophet of the New Testament. In line after line of plain but rhythmic prose, Péguy allows us to hear God the Father, the living God, revealed to us by the Son, speaking in his own voice, as it were, speaking, that is, through his poet prophet Peggy, and speaking out plainly and directly. In one particularly striking passage, which is directly concerned with the theme of hope, we hear God the Father expressing his utter amazement at the fact that human beings, in spite of the trials and disappointments of life, and in spite of the consequent temptations to despair, are still somehow capable of hope. The passage in question is from Peggy's long prose poem, The Portal of the Mystery of Hope. Charity, says God. That doesn't surprise me. It's not surprising. How could human beings not love their brothers? How could they not take the bread from their own mouth, their daily bread, in order to give it to the needy and to the unhappy children? But hope, says God, that is something that surprises me. Even me, that is surprising. That these poor creatures, although well aware of how things are going, can still believe that tomorrow things will go better, that is surprising. And it's by far the greatest marvel of our grace. And I'm surprised by it myself. And my grace must indeed be an incredible force, and must flow freely and like an inexhaustible river ever since the first time it flowed. That time that it flowed like a river of blood from the pierced side of my son. What must my grace and the strength of my grace be that this little hope, vacillating at the breath of sin, trembling with every word, anxious at the slightest breath, be as constant, remain as faithful, as righteous, as pure, and invincible, and immortal, and impossible to extinguish as that little flame in the sanctuary? What surprises me, says God, is hope. And I can't get over it. This little hope, who seems like nothing at all, this little girl, hope, immortal. At a first reading, one might imagine that the emphasis on childlike simplicity and trust in Peggy's work springs from a wholly serene and uncomplicated mind and heart. But the Frenchman's devotional and theological vision, his profound faith awareness, was from the beginning tested and purified in the crucible of certain very painful and unusual circumstances. Peggy was, we can say, a dogmatic poet in an age of unbelief, and yet, not far beneath the surface of his best work, we can hear again and again the cadence of an intensely personal, questioning voice. In his long prose poem, for example, The Portal of the Mystery of Hope, a number of statements voiced for God the Father are statements which, at one level at least, Peggy, it would seem, is addressing to his own heart and addressing, perhaps, at a time of almost unbearable anguish. In one place, he writes, "Put off until tomorrow those concerns and those worries that are eating at you today, and that might devour you today. Put off until tomorrow those sobs that choke you when you see today's misery, those sobs which rise in you and strangle you. Put off until tomorrow those tears that fill your eyes and cover your face, that flood you, that fall down your cheeks." Enormous suffering marked the short life of Charles Péguy. But when we open his collected poems and begin to read the work, the realm we enter into is, to our great surprise, not so much a kingdom of sorrow, but rather a domain of joy and a domain of hope. The sorrow is there, of course. An anguish often evident between the lines, and even on occasion in the lines themselves. Nevertheless, far from being maudlin in any way, Péguy's verse is distinguished throughout by a hard, flame-like spirit and by a virile joy. According to Henri Bergson, the celebrated philosopher and a close acquaintance of the poet, Péguy possessed the marvelous gift of somehow penetrating to the very core of a person's mind. Bergson remarked, "He knew my most secret thought, such as I had never expressed it." I think something of that penetrating gaze still survives today in Péguy's prose and poetry. One may well decide at a certain moment, as in a talk such as this, for example, to take up Péguy's verse and scrutinize it at some length. But soon one begins to realize, and even in the act of scrutiny itself, that while we, as readers or as listeners, are casting a critical eye at the work and a critical eye at the man, Péguy himself, the stubborn celebrant of hope, the defeated, undefeated guardian and prophet of the inner life, the man of enormous sorrow and of enormous joy, is scrutinizing us and piercing us with his gaze. Péguy's vision of hope is without question distinctly childlike, but it is never sentimental. In his prose poem, The Portal of the Mystery of Hope, hope, the virtue of hope, is understood as a force which rises like new blood or like sap in the month of May. Grace that somehow breaks through what he calls the thick skin of our hearts, through the skin of anger, through the skin of despair, through the thick skin of sin. In The Portal, Péguy speaks of carnal pride, our human pride, and distinguishes it from the pride of the fallen angels. Their pride, he insists, was a poor pride of ideas, a pale pride, a vain pride, all in the head. Human pride, in contrast, is a thick and heavy pride, nourished by fat and blood, brimming with health, the skin glowing. Pride of the blood, pride of the flesh, which swells and buzzes throughout the body like a buzzing storm, and which throbs at the temples like the beating of a drum. This pride of the flesh was not redeemed by spirit alone, but by incarnation, by the flesh and blood of Christ. And the parables of Christ form part of the grace of that redemption. They, the parables, speak directly and powerfully to the heart of the weakest sinner. Of all the parables of Christ, the parable of greatest hope, in Péguy's opinion, is the parable of the prodigal son. Péguy writes, "This one has awakened the deepest echo, the most ancient echo, the only one that the sinner has never been able to silence in his heart. The word of hope, then, is the one word that the sinner, even as he turns away from God and buries himself in lost countries and tries to put everything that is sacred out of his mind, will never be able to forget. Again, Peggy writes, "Once this word of hope has bitten into his heart, into his believing or unbelieving heart, no pleasure will ever more be able to erase its teeth marks. Such is this word. She's a word that stays with you. She follows like a dog that remains, even though you beat it." The image is as unexpected as the reality it describes. Hope for Peggy is a mystery of God's love. It is the signature of God's purpose, the grace and surprise of a loving, relentless pursuit, the one pressure of grace that the sinner will never finally be able to elude or escape. In order now to bring this brief reflection to a close, I would like to read another few lines from Peggy, lines which take up once again the theme of the mystery of hope, and which in passing refer to what Peggy calls irrevocable words. These words are, it hardly needs to be said, the words of revelation, the astonishing words of love and of trust, which, even for the least of us, have opened up a door, an entry into a wholly new world. Peggy writes, "Remarkable overturning that runs through all the mysteries and makes them grow, increases them to infinity. You must have confidence in God. God put his hope in us. He took the initiative. He hoped that the least of the sinners, the very least, would work a little for his own salvation. He hoped in us. Will it be said that we didn't hope in him? God placed his hope, his poor hope, in each one of us. Abyss of hope. What an opening, what lightning, what thunder. What a passageway, what an entrance, irrevocable words. What an entry into the very hope of God."
And thanks there to Dominican preacher and poet, Father Paul Murray.
We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Faith, hope, and love, we have been justified. Faith, hope, and love, saved by his blood.
And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.